Blog Talk Radio.
If you love America, you're among friends here. ConservativeNationRadio.org.
Americans, or as Walter Winchell once, he used to say, Mr. and Mrs. North and South America and all the ships at sea, whatever that means. Duke Brooks here. This is Radio Free America on ConservativeNationMedia.com, where America always wins. This is the Wednesday, June 18th edition thereof. Time really flies, doesn't it? And the older you get, the faster it goes, I guarantee it. We do have some very interesting programming tonight. At least I hope that you will agree that it will be interesting. The chat room is open for business, of course. In about 14 minutes or so, Brad Bierman will be joining us to talk about the Washington Redskins situation. In case you're not aware, today, the United States Patent and Trademark Office decided that they were simply going to cancel the trademark of the Washington Redskins. This is in an effort to get the NFL team, which has been around since around, I think, 1931. Brad will have all the facts, to change their name. I'm presuming from Washington Redskins to the Washington Acting Chief Deputy Assistant Staff Administrative Undersecretaries. That's probably what they want to change the name to. You think not? 718-305-7176 is the number. In case you missed it last night, Hillary did an interview with Bret Baier and Greta Van Susteren. From what I'm reading, nobody much cares about her anymore. People have come to the conclusion after, I'm certain after the what at this point difference does it make comment about Benghazi last year. Additionally, when she was an attorney at the Rose Law Firm in Little Rock, she defended a guy in his 40s who was accused and was on trial for raping a 12-year-old girl. She was a defense attorney at the time, and she got the guy acquitted, apparently on some kind of a technicality. Now, I'm not really sure exactly how she did that or why she, apparently somebody taped her talking about this in a very, very kind of flippant configuration, that it was, she thought it was funny that she got the guy acquitted. Last night she said some things on Greta and on Bret Baier on the Fox News Channel interview that while I was watching it with Linda, I was watching and she would make some comments, and she was asked where the president was during Benghazi. And she said, oh, he was in the White House. Then she said he was in the Oval Office. Then, I just don't get it. I think it's incorrect. I think that a lot of those things are going to be proven to be lies. Now, Professor Dr. Ken Glass is with us. Dr. Glass, how are you doing tonight?
Well, I'm doing fine. I'm here and listening to what's going on right now.
Okay, very fine. Now, it is probably my fault, but I guess I got you the wrong time because we're going to start talking about the U.S. Navy in World War II and the Battle of the Philippine Sea about an hour from now. If you want to stand by and continue to listen, I'd be honored, but if you want to call back in about 1 hour, that would be terrific.
No, I'll call back in an hour.
Okay, thank you very much, sir.
All right.
All righty.
Bye.
Thank you, sir. Bye. That was Professor Dr. Ken Glass, and he will be joining us in an hour. And Dr. Glass is a retired professor at Miami University of Ohio, and he is also a veteran of World War II. Dr. Glass actually flew off the USS Hornet, the Hornet II, as it were, during World War II at Philippine Sea, flying a TBF Avenger. And in the next hour, starting about 9 o'clock Eastern Time, 8 o'clock Central, we will be speaking with Professor Dr. Glass and also with Tom Cleaver, author of the book Fabled 15. Tom and I have an awful lot in common. He also writes reviews of, he writes some hobby reviews. I don't know if we're going to go there tonight. And also with David Dixon, who will be calling in from Mississippi and who is the author of the book, The Battle of the Philippine Sea, which is considered by most historians to be the definitive book about that particular very serious World War II battle. We will get into that starting about just about 60 minutes from right now, so make sure that you stay where you are. In the meantime, as I mentioned, Hillary basically last night did a lot of dancing. And at one point, she made the claim that as soon as she knew there was an attack underway, she started calling national security people and the president saying, you've got to do everything you can to help our people. You know what? I've got to be honest with you. I don't believe it. I don't believe it. Who the heck knows what she was doing on that night? But one thing is clear. I simply don't believe what she said. You know, I can't believe anything that that woman says. I suspect that she was behind President Obama's move to remove United States forces from Iraq. And you see what is happening now. This ISIS, which is the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. This is a terrorist group that wants to take over as fundamentalist, devout Mohammedans, Syria, Iraq, and any other place in the Middle East, apparently, that they can get their hands on, and impose radical Sharia law and all that kind of stuff. And we pulled our people out. The president told everybody, we're going to pull our people out. And what do you think the enemy would do? I mean, it's just, you know, it's unbelievable, the naivete and the ignorance. The only thing that the liberal left has a higher level of skill than getting everything wrong is convincing everybody that they're right. And, of course, they are not. They have been wrong about everything. You know, it is just unbelievable. The IRS claims that they have lost all of the emails that Lois Lerner was sending inside and outside the agency between 2009 and 2011. Yeah, right. Forget about it. It's just simply, it's not credible. There's no such thing as an email that disappears. They are out there somewhere. Every expert, there have been so many experts on TV the last 2 days. Listen, if you're old enough to remember the 18-and-a-half-minute gap in the Watergate tapes, the tapes that were recorded in the Oval Office, that President Nixon, you know, allegedly took 18 and a half minutes of audio out before turning them over to the House Watergate Committee. This is the exact same thing. The problem, however, is that the IRS literally is above the law. There is, even the United States Congress just does not have the backbone to stand up to them. because they know that the IRS, they can start auditing individual congressmen and senators. They can start leaking information to the press, and that is something the congressmen and senators just don't want to have happen. Remember Tom Daschle, who was the biggest proponent of big government, the South Dakota Democrat that for years was senator from South Dakota. I think he was either 12 or 18 years, two or three terms, and he was one of the people that was leading the charge after 9-1-1 to come up with yet another federal agency to oversee security at the airport and blah, blah, blah. And then when he had been nominated to a cabinet position by Obama, it turned out that he owed a ton of money in taxes. I mean, this was a guy that just could not wait to advocate. I mean, really advocate for bigger government. And then the apparatus that is used to pay for the bigger government, this is something, you know, he just, the tax code is not only too oppressive, it is also too complex. 718-305-7176 is the number here at Radio Free America on conservativenationmedia.com. Brad Bierman will be joining us shortly, and we will talk about the Washington Redskins. You know, I have lived I've lived in the Mid-Atlantic, the Baltimore, Washington region for a very, very long time. I'm strictly a Baltimore fan. Brad and I certainly will talk a little bit about the fact that my beloved Orioles are now in third place. I can't stand it. But the season is still young, as they say. I was never particularly a Washington Redskins fan. I used to eat with Art Monk when he was an undergraduate football player at Syracuse University. I ate with Art probably 8, 10, 12 times. Very, very nice guy. He's now on the board of directors of Syracuse. Famous player coming out of Syracuse, and a very, very nice guy. Anyway, this is coming from the Sports Illustrated Wire. And it says, let's see here. This was filed today. The U.S. Patent and Trademark Office canceled six federal trademark registrations for the NFL's Washington Redskins today, saying the nickname is disparaging to Native Americans and cannot be trademarked under federal law that prohibits trademark protection on offensive or disparaging language. The team has been under fire for the past year with many groups, including the Yokadihi-Winton Nation, wanting the nickname change. Last month, the team hired a lobbying firm to help with the public backlash after senators sent a letter to the NFL saying they also wanted the name changed. We decide, this is quoting the Trademark Trial and Appeals Board, we decide, based on the evidence properly before us, that these registrations must be canceled because they were disparaging to Native Americans at the respective time they were registered. Unquote. Redskins owner Dan Snyder has repeatedly said that he will not change the nickname despite the opposition. The Trademark Trial and Appeals Board said the Redskins name is the subject for cancellation for, quote, entertainment services, namely football exhibitions rendered in stadia and through the media of radio and television broadcasts, unquote. The team's cheerleading squad, the Redskinettes, are also subject to the cancellation for entertainment services, cheerleaders who perform dance routines at pro games. It is just unbelievable. I was told earlier today, in fact, just recently, that the logo of the Washington Redskins was designed by American Indians and that the team was named Redskins to honor the American Indians. Okay. Listen, there were words that 200 years ago meant one thing, and today they mean completely the opposite. The meanings of words very often change. And, you know, I don't see that being a disparaging term in the context in which it is used and was used back then. Brad Bierman is with us, and Brad probably has some good information about this. Brad, welcome aboard, my friend. How you doing, pal?
Good, Duke. Thank you for having me on tonight. Enjoy it.
My pleasure, buddy. Now, you're not particularly a Washington Redskins fan, but I guess my question is, where is all this coming from? Is there a groundswell of opinion against the Washington Redskins, the Atlanta Braves, and the Cleveland Indians, or not? I don't know. What's your take on this?
My take is the groundswell of opposition is more on the Redskins' name than the Braves or Indians, only because they're more generic, if you will, and not as specific a slur as said by the people that are protesting the name and want it changed. My take after the announcement today by the Federal Trademark Office that they were going to, after 77 years, remove that protection is, kind of think it's going to start to get scary if the government's going to step in and get involved with names, nicknames of professional sports teams. I think there's probably other ways in which those against the name could band in support and try to pressure or guilt Dan Snyder into changing the name, but I don't see how there's the fluidity of the government getting involved here and then deciding, you know, what's a slur. You know, I mean, is Land O'Lakes butter a slur because there's an Indian on the carton? You know what I'm saying?
That's a good question. And since when is it up to government to be determining, this entire politically correct mentality that we're now in? I mean, as you mentioned, it's been 3/4 of a century that they have had that name, and it's only been very, very recently that apparently anybody has complained about it. And
your show and talking to a lot of folks each week, I mean, I think what happens is we have different, right, political climates, social media today, different causes get a lot of oomph behind it. I simply think that, you know, they went to the trademark office 10 years ago, as you and I have talked about, and that was an appeal situation. So here it is 10 years later. If there's no name change, will it happen in 5 years from now or 10 years from now? It's just hard to predict, but I agree with you. The bottom line is let the owner of the team, the National Football League, all those other constituents be involved in any potential change, but certainly not the government.
Yeah, no question about it. Now, I'm wondering what exactly the government can, you know, if they can force the owner of a private business, albeit one with an extraordinarily high profile, and one that is, what do you think the Washington Redskins franchise is worth? Is it worth more than $1 billion, do you think?
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Just over $1 billion, no doubt about that, yep.
Okay, all right. Speaking of $1 billion, what is the latest on the Los Angeles Clippers?
That's going to go to court. There's no doubt about it. That's going to go all the way to the end. Donald Sterling is not going to go quietly.
Okay. All right, good. Well, I'm just not sure that he should be made to. We are now literally getting into the depths to which the thought police can enter into people's private lives and into people's private thinking. And, you know, I don't know about you, but I just don't think that is a very good idea. And frankly, I think it's un-American. The First Amendment is there not to protect popular speech, but to protect unpopular speech. You're still not allowed to yell fire in a crowded theater. But, I can guarantee you that there will be a time in the future when people will find the idea that Americans were doing certain things, whatever they are, right now in the second decade of the 21st century, they will find it to be utterly and that we take every day, no big deal. People 200 or 150 years from now will find some of our conduct today to be utterly and completely reprehensible, the same way we look upon slavery now. 150 years ago, we were fighting a massive civil war about it. 175 years ago, most people really didn't give it all that much attention. So things change over time. But if the federal government can force a team to do that, I would think that there would be some owners that would be, or potential owners or investors that would be very, very worried as to what else the federal government could do if they decided they wanted to have a team. It might put a real, yeah, I mean, if they can do that, then maybe the federal government can regulate what the owners of private businesses are allowed to say in public. That wouldn't be right at all. What do you think? What's
the future? Oh, that certainly, I agree. It certainly would be a very slippery slope. I mean, I just don't see how the government is equipped to make these determinations, right, as to what's vulgar, what's a slur. I mean, every day, almost any minute of every day, we all could be subjected to something that we found offensive, right? I mean, it's just so subjective.
No question.
And so, I mean, you could turn on a TV show on, you know, HBO and, you know, you could be offended. You could turn on the news and be offended just by how they present it. So, yeah, there's just no place for the government to be involved in this.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, from what I understand, I mean, I'm not that much of a football fan. I mean, I love it when the Ravens are winning. I'm basically just a Baltimore fan. But the Redskins apparently did not have a great year last year. I mean, fill me in on you know, what they're expecting to be looking like 2 months from now when we're into the season.
Well, they have a new coach, Jay Gruden, who replaced Mike Shanahan in Washington. And you're right, they've struggled, and they probably won't be projected to do very well in the NFC East this coming season. They certainly have a good young quarterback in Robert Griffin, RG3. But it's going to be interesting to see with a rookie head coach in Gruden what he does. I guess there's nowhere to go but up for the team from a performance standpoint. But you know, from being around D.C. as long as you have, I mean, the Redskins fan base is just as fervent as any in the National Football League and has been for, you know, certainly in the time they've been in their present stadium and, you know, certainly have a 50-year legacy at least.
Yeah, it is a storied team. What was the first team in the National Football League? Was it the Cleveland Browns or the Packers? Who was it?
Maybe even the Portsmouth team from Portsmouth, Ohio. If you're going way back to pre-NFL days, they had another name for the league. But Duluth, Portsmouth, they had Green Bay. They had some really small markets back in the day. Don't forget, of course, and baseball was the sport in this country.
Oh yeah.
During the infancy of professional football, and college football was more popular than professional football until a player named Red Grange, the galloping ghost out of Illinois, joined the Chicago Bears in the 1930s.
Okay, so the Bears might have been one of the first teams. The Packers are the only team that is publicly owned. Is that correct?
Yes. Bears' origin, I believe, was in Decatur, Illinois. Decatur.
Okay. And they, you know, I once heard someone say that the NFL traces its origins to the 1922 football season. That, you know, that could be correct for all I know. The major problem with this, I mean, I'm wondering what is going to happen if fans begin really pushing back and, you know, really exerting some pressure. I mean, if somebody doesn't want to go to the game, they are completely within their rights to boycott the game. But I don't think anybody is within their rights to force the owner of a private business to change the name of their business because literally a handful of people were obviously looking very hard to find something by which they could be offended. It is just absolutely bizarre what is going on in this country now.
Yeah, and I wanted to give you some background. I punched it up. The NFL really dates back as far as 1892, Duke, believe it or not. But really the modern era was 1922. And the two teams currently in the league that trace their origin back to the beginning are the Decatur Staleys, which are now the Chicago Bears, who originated in Decatur, Illinois. And then the Chicago Cardinals, who are now the Arizona Cardinals.
Yeah, okay, so then they were the Chicago Cardinals and then the St. Louis Cardinals and then Arizona.
Right, and Green Bay was founded in 1919, joined the NFL in 1921, so they are the oldest franchise in continuous operation.
Wow, okay, all right.
In the same
location. I remember a couple of years ago, I think in 2012, I was actually buying some advertising on Facebook, and I called up. They have an 800 number, you know. And the guy that I got on the phone was a guy from New Zealand, and he lived in Arizona, and he was working for Facebook. And, you know, while he was doing various things on the computer, he and I were chatting, and he said he had recently gone to a Green Bay Packers game, I think against the Saints or the Panthers or Jaguars or whatever.
In Green Bay?
Yeah. And I said to him, you know, it's unbelievable. You come to America, you know, he had only been here for a couple of months, and the guy gets to go to a Green Bay Packers game. Unbelievable. You know, some people have all the luck, huh?
It's a great atmosphere, Duke, at Green Bay on NFL game days because I consider the atmosphere there closest to college football in regards to the amount of tailgating and just kind of the joyous atmosphere among the folks that are tailgating there because, you know, Green Bay isn't exactly the largest market in the National Football League. And
it's the smallest
nice town with nice folks in their Midwestern roots there, and they're very fervent for their Packers. Many of those fans, as you mentioned, own a part of the team.
Yeah. Yeah, there. I have seen pictures and videos from the parking lot at Lambeau Field, and there are people that set up there, and they tailgate, and they have their certificate of stock framed, and they're showing it to people as they walk by, and it must be unbelievable. It must wouldn't that be a great souvenir.
Attach it to their vehicles in the parking lot so everyone can see them walking by, yes.
Yeah, oh, exactly, exactly. Well, I mean, it's, you know, this is a very, very bad precedent for the federal government to be deciding what people may and may not think, and that ultimately that's what it comes down to. Nobody is trying to come up with a team called the Detroit N-Words or the Dearborn, Michigan Camel Jockeys or anything. Nobody's trying to do that. And I don't think anybody was trying to insult the American Indians when they called that team the Redskins. But I digress. Now, the Orioles are... they beat Tampa Bay apparently today, but they're in third place, 3.5 games behind Toronto. They're tied for they're just a hair behind the New York Yankees. How long until the All-Star break? Isn't that normally
that
like
comes up the second
of
week of July?
Okay, all right, very fine. But it's still way too early to determine what the playoff season is going to look like, isn't it?
Oh, yes, yes. Way too early for that. You know, the old adage, you know, come September 1, you can kind of worry about that as to to who, you know, might be in contention. But the Orioles are 37-34. They're 3.5 games
yep.
behind Toronto, along with the Yankees. They've won two in a row. They've struggled at home this year, Duke. They're only 16-17, but they've done well on the road at 21-17. And I've got to say, overall, the last time I was on the show, I had mentioned that stay, hang in there, O's fans, because I really think that that Mr. Showalter has got the right mix this season. And I really think that they can stay
yeah.
in this race for most of the year.
Well, I sure hope that they can. Buddy, thank you for joining me tonight, and I hope to have you back on the air. Let's try doing this again at some point right after the All-Star break when things heat up, huh?
That would be great, Duke. Always enjoy talking with you, sports and Orioles and Baltimore sports on the program.
Fantastic. Thank you, my friend, and please give my very best to your wife, Cindy. I'm glad to hear she's doing so much better.
Thank you, Duke. I appreciate that. I'll pass those wishes on, and good luck. Continued success.
All right, pal. Thanks very much. See you soon. All righty. Always a pleasure to have Brad on the air. He is a world-class sports expert, which very obviously I am not a world-class sports expert. You know, one of the worst things that can happen to anybody today is to be victimized by identity theft. You trust me, you don't want that to happen to you. If it does, it could take you weeks, months, maybe even longer to recover from it. If you can recover at all, there's a lot of people that are not able to recover from that, and their lives have been ruined. The best thing that you can possibly do is to make sure that it doesn't happen to you, and the best way to do that is to use LifeLock. LifeLock is a lot more than just a regular credit monitoring service. They are there for you 24/7, 365, with a combination of outstanding member service and their own very specialized data surveillance techniques. There truly is nothing that even comes close to LifeLock. Now, to protect your credit, your financial information, your future, and get 10% off of LifeLock's great service, you want to go to our website, which is conservativenationmedia.com, click on the LifeLock banner, and then percent off of their great service. I see Uncle Bing is in the chat room. Very fine, my buddy. So click on the LifeLock banner on conservativenationmedia.com, where America always wins, and begin protecting yourself right now with LifeLock. You will be very glad you did. More coming up with the IRS situation, the missing IRS emails, which is to me is in the same category as the dog ate my homework, and a whole bunch of other things, Hillary on Benghazi and all that stuff. Your calls, too. Stay right where you are.
It's Thursday night, and you're grabbing drinks with some friends. Started off with a pitcher for the table, which quickly becomes two. There's pool. And there's the photo booth.
All right, everybody squeeze in. Say cheese!
Followed naturally by an order of wings. And another.
Can we get some extra ranch sauce?
Then there's the ceremonial nightcap.
So what are we doing this weekend?
And lastly, it's back to the car, which, if you're buzzed... could be the most expensive night of your life. Getting pulled over for buzz driving could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. Nothing kills a buzz like getting pulled over for buzz driving, because buzz driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
One goat can make the difference between nourishment and hunger. One goat can make the difference between poverty and sustained income. In the war-torn areas of southern Sudan, one goat can make the difference between life and death. Find out how you can help. Visit goatsfortheoldgoat.org. That's goats, F-O-R, theoldgoat.org. Fighting hunger, one goat at a time.
Hi, this is Michael Behrman. inviting you to join me every Sunday at 4 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Central on The Michael Berryman Show.
Hit me!
Right here on conservativenationmedia.com.
Hey, liberals, why don't you try rooting for your own damn country for a change? You're listening to Duke Brooks on conservativenationradio.org.
Oh, absolutely. That is a question that I ask the liberals all the time. What is it that they find so absolutely awful about this country, their own country, that they just cannot find it within themselves to want America to win, to be successful, even to survive? Unbelievable. 718-305-7176. I am having some trouble with my mouse. And if I sounded flustered a moment or two ago, or if I sound flustered all night long, that is the reason. Not really sure what's up with it, but hitting that left button just does not, isn't doing what it is supposed to do. 718-305-7176 is the number. About half an hour from now, today is the 80th, I'm sorry, it is not the 80th, it is the 70th anniversary of the, we're in the middle of the 70th anniversary of the Battle of the Philippine Sea, which is also known as the Great Marianas Turkey Shoot, and we have some really great guests lined up to discuss that. Author Tom Cleaver, author David Dixon is going to be with us, and Dr. Ken Glass, an actual veteran of the battle, so you're going to want to be here for that. So make sure that you stick around. 718-305-7176. Hillary's dance last night on Bret Baier and Bret Van Susteren, I thought was utterly, you know, she really has no business being president of the United States. She has absolutely no business moving back into the White House, just bizarre. We have had strange presidential campaigns and strange presidential families, and it just, you know, before I think it was William Howard Taft, the only president to be president during two non-consecutive terms. And I think afterwards he was a justice on the Supreme Court. I mean, you know, there are some of these people that get involved in government. Either they can't figure out what else to do with their lives, or they are just people that are so certain that they are absolutely right about absolutely everything, and as a result, they figure that they can tell everybody else what to do, and they are just entitled to tell everybody else what to do. I call that a psychological bias towards self-confirmation. I don't know what you call it. 718-305-7176 is the number here at Radio Free Delmarva. I was hoping to hear from Christian from Denmark tonight, but I suspect that Christian is so much more focused on this soccer game that's going on, I guess, in Brazil, that he just, you know, was not able to call in. I don't understand the Europeans and their fascination with that game, which, you know, it is a very athletically grueling game. There's no question it's not a violent game the way football is in America. It doesn't move nearly as fast as ice hockey. I don't think anything except polo moves as fast as ice hockey. And let me tell you, having played quite a few chuckers in my own life, polo is a very fast-moving sport. And if you don't know what you're doing, you can get very, very seriously hurt in that game. But I digress. So, but the Europeans, Yeah, I saw something really funny on Facebook. I thought this was beautiful. Somebody had written, if I'm going to stand around for 90 minutes and watch somebody try to score, I may as well go to a bar. Hey, you know, I gotcha. I understand what you mean. It is, to me, it's just kind of a boring game. I just don't get it. I do not get it. Let us join Mr. Bing Fisher. Bing, what's going on, pal?
Hey, Duke, how you doing, man? Fantastic Wednesday. It's hot down here in Tennessee.
Well, it's hot here in Delaware, and during a lot of the day today, I was outside in the yard literally chopping down a tree, and I don't think I have sweated that profusely since I was an oarsman at Syracuse University in the mid-1970s, and I'm telling you, I was drenched. I have never enjoyed a shower as much as I did after that workout, but you've got some news. You are moving to Monday, aren't you? Isn't American by Design
American
moving
by
to
design.
Mondays?
Yep, we're going to go from Sundays to Mondays, and that'll be 7 to 9 p.m. CST, Central Standard Time. This week, I was very, very glad to, or we will be glad to have Scotty Nell Hughes from, from the Tea Party Nation News Service,
yeah.
And it's also a Fox News contributor and so on. And she's just a great talent and very beautiful and just smart, and she's I'm very glad for this, and it will help me, I think, transition over to Monday a little bit easier. So I just wanted to call and let you know about that. But you were talking about soccer, and I played the game. I was in high school soccer for quite a few 3 years, I think, 2-3 years, and it's a grueling game when you're playing it, huh?
Oh, you're going to run 10 miles in one game,
Yeah. There's a lot of runs.
You're going to run 10 miles in one game, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You definitely run a lot. I played fullback and what they called striker, which you play forward. But it's a fun sport. I mean, I'd rather watch soccer than golf. I just don't get golf. Golf is just a weird game, but to me, I mean, if somebody wants to shoot a golf ball up in the air and I blow it away with my shotgun, that would be a cool game. And somebody needs to market that and come up with that and build up that. like golf skeet or something,
Yeah, well, back in the 1990s, one of the beer companies had a series of commercials on the air called Combinations. And one of them I remember was it was a combination of baseball and fishing. And you hear this announcer who says, Johnston reaching into his creel for a fresh bass, and he dropped the bass. He dropped the bass. Maybe that's maybe that should be next, and you're going to go out and not. It's, target practice with a golf ball or something. Who knows? But soccer, everybody knows that you have to be an immensely athletic, in shape and fit individual to be able to play soccer. It is, you may as well be a marathon runner. That's how hard it is. Everybody knows that. But, it just doesn't,
It's a European type sport. It's not really an American sport, but I mean, you got soccer moms out there, and that's what they do with their kids. And it's interesting. I mean, it does take a lot of skill. I mean, it's not just athleticism. It takes a lot of skill to be able to put that ball up in the high nine, where they call the high nine, which is the up top, between, the two corners on the goals. You know, that's where you want that ball to go. Sometimes, and, you know, I mean, when I was playing, I mean, we would, you know, our goalie would get rushed or, you know, somebody would, you know, toe ball somebody, which toe balling is another art form too in itself, and it really doesn't take that much art. It just takes a lot of power where you just kick the ball in, with the front of your foot, and you have the most power when you kick the ball with a part of your foot that it's less square inches. You're concentrating that energy and that power, and that what we used to do, and not that it was promoted back then, but it was done because, you know, somebody would get hurt on the field because of somebody else doing knocking somebody over or whatever, and, you know, you'd go out and toe ball the next guy, and that ball would fly like a rocket and hit the other dude. And, you know, it's a weird sport, man. It's a very strange sport, but it's very – you do have to have a lot of talent to get that ball to the goal. And the goalies now are just so tremendous. It's unbelievable.
I understand that. Now, I'm seeing Christian from Denmark in the chat room right now, and he's saying that soccer is played – totally differently in Europe than in the United States, and I would like Christian to call in. He says that he used to coach soccer, so, you know, we can hear from him. But let me ask you this: I spoke with a friend of mine earlier today, and I told him that there are some pretty bad things going on in Tennessee right now in terms of the number of Mohammedans that are moving in and essentially, you know, setting up shop in the state. Is there somebody in Tennessee that is inviting them?
No, I think what it is, and that this is my take on it, Duke, all right, is that Tennessee is in the Bible Belt, right? I mean, we're in the heartland of the Bible Belt. So why are the mosques and the Muslims trying to infiltrate, especially Murfreesboro and some areas around Nashville and so on? Well, to me, it's because if they can win the Bible Belt, then they can win the rest of the country, can't they? Because, you know, why would they go to Idaho somewhere or some other place that, you know, or New York where, you know, they're not as religious. If they can win the Bible Belt, then they can win the rest of the country. And Tennessee, if you notice, look, if you look on any map, Tennessee is very, very red. We've got a total Republican legislature here, Congress, the House, everything, and our governor. And if they can win here, and this is their way of getting in to the state, and they already have gotten in, so we're trying to get them out, but it's not been easy, but not with this current legislature that we have, because nobody's got the C.O. Jones to get them out.
Right. Well, Bing, you are starting next Monday night, which is June 23rd, 8:00 Eastern, 7 Central. American by Design moving to Monday. I can't wait to hear it, pal.
Oh, yeah, it's going to be fun, man. We're going to talk to Scotty Nell, and we're going to talk to her about the Cantor loss and how the Tea Party, and not just the Tea Party itself, but the movement in the minds of people. They're tired of these career politicians. We've got one out here called Lamar Alexander. We're trying to replace him with Joe Carr, and he's been in politics for 30 years, not Joe Carr, but Lamar Alexander, and the guy is not good. He's not good for Tennessee. He's not good for America, so that's what we're trying to do here.
No, I'll bet you he's good for Lamar Alexander, though. All right, Bing, thanks for calling in, my buddy. I'll be talking to you again very, very soon. Oh, sorry about that. Always a pleasure to hear from Bing, and always a pleasure to hear from Christian from Denmark. Christian, all I have to say is goal. Isn't that what they do when somebody scores? You know, everybody goes goal, or they blow this plastic trumpet called the Vuvuzela or something. What's up with that?
Hello, good evening to you, and your listeners.
How you doing
from Denmark? The Vuvuzelas. They were only in the South African World Cup. They're not being used in Europe. And I just want to say, you know, about soccer. I've seen some soccer in America, and just to let you know, in the 90s, I coached soccer, youth soccer, for about 10 years. So I know what I'm talking about. And the thing is that soccer is really my passion, and I've been that for 30 years, so I know something about it. And the thing is that it's played very differently. In America, it's very much like a girly sport, where you just come and you play, you kick the ball around and score some goals, and that's that. In Europe and in South America, Argentina and Brazil, it's very different. It's a very tough game. I would dare to say that it's even more tough than American football, you know, the NFL, because there are no protection gear. And they're really, you know, going at it at each other. Over in America, there's a much fair play, and you don't really tackle that hard. Here in Europe, you're really going at it, and it's really a contact sport. So, you got bloody knees all over the place, and injuries left and right here in it. So it's really a tough game over here. And I just think that's important to get across. Speaking about soccer, I think it's just because I was watching the five. I watch the five almost every day, and they have been bashing soccer, and they have been bashing soccer a lot. And I really think that's a mistake, because the right wing of America, you know, the Tea Party and the Republicans. They would want to get the Europeans on their side, but every time they start bashing soccer, they lose Europeans, because to many Europeans, soccer is more than just a sport. It's a religion. They love their favorite soccer team more than
you don't want to allocate. And there are places and communities and regions in the United States where American football is their religion. And, you know, you're going to find dedicated sports fans all over the world, and there are people in Russia that focus their entire lives on ballet. I'm not sure anywhere outside of Russia is that done, you know?
But then I'm just saying that it's just, you know, it's not very smart to alienate so many people, you know, by bashing their favorite pastime thing, their passion. So really think that I was really getting annoyed when I saw that on the five, that this soccer bashing. I think it's okay, you know, to have another sport that is your favorite sport. I just think
nobody in Europe, baseball has never been popular in Europe. American football has never been popular in Europe. Hockey is, and basketball is. But we really don't care that the Europeans don't like our two key games. I mean, apparently the only place in the entire world where baseball is not particularly popular is Western Europe. In the Orient, people, they play it all through South America. Yeah, I mean, those things don't matter. The way I look at it is that American, we have our sports, which we invented in this country, that are reflective of a lot of things, American values, some American history. And in Europe, sports that are reflective of their values. And you know, maybe it is not a one-size-fits-all. Maybe the Europeans ought to remain focused on soccer. I'm sure that there are Europeans that sit around and they talk about how brutal, barbaric, and unsophisticated and uncouth football is, and how silly baseball is.
Not really.
And they're
not
allowed
really
to do it. They can do that.
Not really. Actually, American football is growing fast in popularity over here. There are a fast increasing number of Danes that are fans of it, and you know, the games are showed on Danish TV with Danish commentators and, you know, from the NFL. And there's a fast-growing community of people watching it. So it is growing, and I just think, you know, that we respect each other's, you know, sports and passion. That's always a good way to gain support for your beliefs. And I just think that that athletes got to be respected, because no matter what sport it is, you know, it takes discipline, it takes sacrifice, it takes hard work day in and day out for a long period of time to reach the top. And
sure.
I just think that no matter if what sport is, it deserves respect. That's just what I think.
Yes, I
just have one question. And then I just have one question here about the American football.
Sure.
Because that always puzzled me. I think it's funny that you call it football, because don't you really catch, throw the ball more around than you kick it around?
Yes, that is correct.
In a typical
game of football, it is actually very rarely kicked. Why
so
it is called football, I really don't know. I really don't know.
So that's it should be called handball instead. Handball
is something else. Handball is something else. Now, what are you hearing? We've got about 3 minutes. What are you hearing in Denmark and in Europe about the fact that after Obama announced he was going to pull all the troops out of Iraq, the next thing you know, the Mohammedans are invading Iraq, and they've taken over large portions of it. I mean, does Obama look like – do people think the guy looks like an idiot?
I wish I could say yes, but in Danish media, they don't really report negative things about Obama, because, you know, they've been telling the viewers – all the time that he's the greatest ever, and it's so it would look back on bad on them if he all of a sudden turned out to be a bad president. But there is increasing reports about the problems, many reports about the problems in Iraq, and it is being talked about that that president perhaps are not that engaged in it. But it's not being problematized, unfortunately, over here.
Obama obviously is a guy that just kind of has a, you know, this belief that if he is just really, really nice to everybody, that everybody will be nice to America and we won't have to worry about anything, and he simply does not seem to understand.
I just don't think he cares. I just don't think he cares.
Well,
he
wants to diminish America's influence and role in the world. That's what he wants to do. He wants to make America less important, and he wants to see, I mean, primarily, like all leftists, he wants to see a socialist country lead the world. And unfortunately, right now, the socialist countries, which is, I mean, this is the problem with socialism, is that it does not work. So there are no real socialist countries that are in any position to do anything like that. And he and Bill Clinton and Hillary and the rest of the professional left in this country are sitting around twirling their thumbs, wringing their hands, and saying, oh my, oh my, oh my, and they can't figure out why that is, because they're not very bright is what it comes down to. Unbelievable.
Yeah. And it is. I just think it seems to me like, you know, Obama, he got elected on his main objective was really, I think really he has delivered on a lot of things. He has delivered on healthcare. Yes, you know, got his Obamacare through, even though you know many of us probably don't agree with the center.
I don't.
But you know, he still promised the electorate you will get Obamacare, and he delivered on that. And he also, you know, he made no claims that he will lead a strong America out in the world. He said he would not.
No.
And so he also delivered on that. So. So isn't that really the thing that he has just done as his promise? And now we see the results. You know, we got a world run amok because they know that the Americans not going to interfere. So it's basically like a free-for-all for crazies and the Muslims. Because
we're at the top of the hour, so I've got to get going. But I look forward to speaking to you again next week, my friend.
So we're, God bless America.
Thank you, my friend. Always a pleasure. Alrighty, we are at the top of the hour now, and that means we've got news from Talk Radio News Service with Keely Sullivan coming up. After that, we'll be speaking with Tom and Ken and Dave about the Battle of the Philippine Sea. Don't go away.
Coming to you every hour on the hour. The weather's fine, but the man.
If you love America, you're among friends here. ConservativeNationRadio.org.
From the Talk Radio News Service, I'm Keely Sullivan. The Department of Interior announced that $436.9 million are being distributed to almost 2,000 local governments. The money, under the Payment in Lieu of Taxes program, will compensate local governments for their non-taxable federal land. Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington Executive Director Melanie Sloan says that missing emails, such as the Lois Lerner emails lost by the Internal Revenue Service, are old news. Sloan remembered missing SEC records during the Madoff investigation and millions of missing emails from the George W. Bush administration. According to the Department of Justice, SunTrust Mortgage Incorporated will pay $968 million to settle mortgage origination, loan servicing, and foreclosure abuses. The fine will be a $500 million payment to consumer relief and another $418 million for violating the False Claims Act. Keely Sullivan, Talk Radio News Service, Washington.
Americans have known Tennessee as the volunteer state since the War of 1812. Now, Tennessee is leading the way in another major conflict, the war to keep America's identity, values, and freedoms intact. Even if you've never walked in Memphis or hiked the Blue Ridge Mountains, if you respect traditional American values, you should know about the Tennessee Action Council. Tennessee Action Council fights to preserve American values, defend our way of life, and protect the U.S. Constitution. This isn't just Tennessee's battle. It affects every American who loves our country and wants to pass the real America, unstained by progressive liberalism, along to future generations. No matter where you are in this magnificent country of ours, Tennessee Action Council is on your side and on America's side. Go to TN4Action.com. That's TN, the number 4, Action.com to volunteer for Tennessee and America. That's TN, the number 4, Action.com to stand for America now.
Been looking for an online gathering place? You know, a familiar screen, does everything you're used to, except give you grief for being a conservative? You've got to try the Tea Party community. At TPC, you'll know how everything works from the very first minute, and you'll probably find a lot of friends who are already there. Organize, communicate, share ideas, upcoming events, pictures, and videos. The Tea Party community connects and empowers like-minded, politically conservative people like you. Sign up today at TeaPartyCommunity.com.
Molon LeBay Challenge Coins and Wares. Similar to challenge coins used by various military units, these MLCCW coins are ideal for anyone that champions the right to keep and bear arms by highlighting the Second Amendment and the Greek phrase Molon LeBay, which translated means come and take them. Come check out our pro-freedom, pro-liberty, and pro-Second Amendment coins and shirts at MLCCW.com. That's MLCCW.com.
Welcome back to Radio Free America on ConservativeNationMedia.com. Duke Brooks here, about 4 minutes now after 9 o'clock, Wednesday, that's 9 p.m. Eastern Time. on Wednesday, June 18th. And I am joined by Dr. Ken Glass, an actual veteran of World War II. Dr. Glass, welcome aboard. I'm so glad that you could make it. How are you doing tonight, sir?
Well, thank you. And refer to me as Ken, will you please?
Okay, Ken. My parents brought me up to be respectful of people, but thank you so much. I really appreciate that. And also,
okay,
Tom Cleaver is with us from California. And Tom, since you are in California, I'm going to say, hey, man, how are you doing, man? Out in California, Tom, like, wow, dude. You know, anyway,
I'm doing
gents,
okay.
All right, 70 years ago today.
Tomorrow.
Actually, for a couple of days, around the middle of June in 1944. The United States was involved in taking back the Philippines from the Japanese, and
the Marianas.
The Marianas.
You're 4 months early.
Oh, all right. Now then, okay. So my knowledge of the Pacific War is kind of limited to Pearl Harbor and Midway because, frankly, everything else is just too complicated for me to understand.
Huh,
but
why don't you?
Well, please do. Yeah, and why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about that, Tom, and then we'll ask Ken to tell us about his actual experience flying torpedo bombers in the Pacific in World War II.
Well, the Marianas were the first invasion of what would be called Japan's inner perimeter of their empire. And everybody knew as soon as they decided they were going to do this that there would have to be a fight, because for the Japanese were well aware of the B-29 and what it was going to be capable of, and they knew that it would be based on the Marianas and capable of bombing Japan, so they were going to have a fight. It would be the first carrier battle since Santa Cruz in October 1942, and the Japanese were also still operating under a problem of not really understanding exactly how powerful their enemy was, because they mistook the invasion of Biak at the end of May as being the main American invasion for 1944. They sent a reconnaissance plane over Majuro and didn't see any carriers because they were out striking other targets at the time, and decided that Biak must be it. So they prepared to launch their carrier force, which came over from Singapore to Tawi Tawi in the Philippines. Prepared to launch their battleship force against the invasion of Biak, and then they got involved with a problem that showed up. They thought there was a wolf pack of submarines outside their anchorage at Tawi Tawi. They were actually up against the USS Harder, Sam Dealey's boat, and he sank enough destroyers over the course of a week that they thought an entire fleet of submarines out there waiting for them. And the Japanese battleship sortied a day early on July 10th. And then on July 11th, the American Fifth Fleet showed up off of the Marianas, and the Japanese realized that they didn't know how strong their enemy was, and the Japanese carriers been sortied. They had a little bit of problem about getting the two forces together, but between June 11th and June 19th, the United States was primarily involved in invading Saipan and then Tinian, and going in there. The Fifth Fleet was there under Spruance to defend the invasion. The Japanese were hoping that once the Fifth Fleet spotted the carriers, they would move further west, which would allow the Japanese then to launch aircraft from the carriers, hit the fleet, land on Guam, and then make the route back to the carriers. At the time, the Japanese actually had more aircraft on their carriers than we did, but their force was really not capable, because over the course of the previous 9 months, hello?
Sorry, no, you're still there. Go
ahead.
God,
I'm getting
go
a
ahead.
Headache.
I'm
getting
actually
a
calling
headache.
You,
Hello?
Duke Dixon. David?
Yes.
Hey,
Pardon?
It's Duke Brooks. It's Duke Brooks at Radio Free America. Just stand by. I'm going to put you on the air in a moment. We're speaking with Tom Cleaver and Ken Glass. So hang on a second, David, all right? All right, Tom, I'm sorry about that. Please,
okay.
I'm having trouble with my mouse.
The Japanese
my mouse is not working. So I've got a real problem here. All I have to, anytime I move it anywhere on the screen, it clicks everything, and that's why we're having these problems. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. Anyway, the Japanese Naval Air Force had been chewed up in the Solomons, particularly in the Rabaul campaign, where they had sent carrier aircraft in the previous fall and winter to Rabaul, and so while they had more aircraft on their carriers, their pilots were far less the pilots and other aircrew were far less capable. The pilots had an average of about 150 to maybe 180 hours, and were barely capable of getting on and off a carrier. The Americans that they were up against had landed on their carriers the first time with 400 hours, while half the American fleet was newcomers to the battle, and none of them had seen a carrier battle before. They all greatly outweighed the Japanese in terms of experience. And the Americans were also under a problem in that to launch aircraft, the prevailing winds were from the east. The Japanese could steam towards the Americans and launch aircraft and recover them. The Americans had to turn away from the enemy, so that by the time they had finished launching a strike, they'd added several miles to the flight pattern for the pilots. That was the big problem in the mission Beyond Darkness. But on June 19th, the Japanese finally attacked, and what we didn't know while the carrier aircraft were busy shooting down Japanese airplanes, they shot down well over 300 during the course of the day. We did not know that two American submarines had gotten in, and the Kavala torpedoed Taiho, the newest one, and then Kavala, which is the newer submarine, torpedoed Shokoku. Neither submarine knew what the results of their strike was, because they were immediately under attack from destroyers. But ultimately, both of those carriers were sunk, a fact we were not aware of for several months afterwards. That was actually the biggest blow against the Japanese carriers, was struck by the submarines. But after the air battle of June 19th, finally the Japanese fleet was spotted on the 20th, and finally at four p.m. and Ken will remember this event. At about 4 p.m. that day, the decision was made to launch the strike at the Japanese fleet. It was going to be maximum range. There was a good possibility that a lot of guys would not be able to get back, and that almost all of them who got back would have to land at night, and most of them were not night qualified. It's called the Mission Beyond Darkness as a result of that, it did result in damage, in sinking one light Japanese carrier, and damaging other ships. But the overall thought was at the time that the strike had not been as devastating to the Japanese as hoped, but that was because they didn't know what the submarines had done earlier that day. The end result, actually, at the end of the Battle of the Philippine Sea, was that Japanese carrier aviation was over and finished. It was a real shadow of its former self. 4 months later, four carriers would end up off of Cape Engano in the Philippines, and they'd have between them 138 airplanes. 108 were capable of a one-way mission because they couldn't land back aboard a carrier, and the other 20 would be kept for air defense, and they were reduced to being used as bait for the Americans. So the Philippine Sea is an important battle. It really is the finishing off of Japanese naval aviation.
Sure. Let's bring in David Dixon in Mississippi, if I can get my mouse to work, which at this moment is kind of an open question. David, are you with us?
Yes.
Okay, very fine. Yes, I can. And David, if you would give us, just because I know your time is limited tonight, if you could give us just kind of a brief strategic overview of the Battle of the Philippine Sea. How did we arrive there? What were we? What were our goals? Just the main players, and then Tom and Ken Glass will pick it up from there, if that's okay with you.
Sure. All right, well, the American objective was the Marianas, which was four islands, Saipan, Tinian, Guam, and Rota, and the attack on Saipan was, I think, June the 15th, and that triggered the sortie of the Japanese fleet, which was in the southern Philippines. Their carrier force had been waiting there to counter any American intrusion into the Central Pacific. And that was the basic strategic situation. The Japanese were placed there to respond to American attacks in various places, and the Marianas was one of the places that they were expected to respond to. And that's the overall strategic situation. They had nine carriers, and we had 15, and it was far and away the biggest carrier battle ever, and you know, likely ever will be. But they had about fewer than 500 airplanes, and the Americans had over 900, and so the deck was stacked. And as already been stated, the quality of the aviators on the two sides was way skewed towards the Americans. The Japanese pilots had been, Japanese naval aviation had been chewed up from the Solomons on up, and by the time they were putting their ships in place to respond to the Americans, they had very poorly trained aviators.
Well, the Japanese, I think at that point, almost were pretty much beaten, but I guess they didn't know that they were beaten. David, what would have been, and you are the author of what no less a source than John Parshall describes as the definitive book on the Battle of the Philippine Sea of eponymous. Well, I was going to say it is eponymous. In other words, the title and the subject are one and the same.
Yeah.
But what would the consequences have been if the United States had lost that carrier versus carrier battle? What would our strategy have had to change to if we had lost?
If we had lost, I think that is highly improbable. But I'll try to figure out what would have happened if we had lost. I think we would have come back for a second trip. I mean, I think that we had more carriers coming out, and they didn't. And I just think that if somehow or other they had pulled it off, it would have set us back for 6 months maybe, but I think that's all that would happen, frankly.
Okay.
You'd have to define defeat. I mean, I have a lot of trouble imagining them sinking. If they had had the best possible results from their side, if they had had better trained pilots and they had the best possible results, it's hard for me to see them knocking out more than three or four American carriers, and that's not going to get them what you want as a defeat. It would have been embarrassing, but it wouldn't have been a defeat.
Okay.
I think
all right, David, thank you. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I just think that I'm of the school that Pearl Harbor was the battle that lost the war for Japan. It steeled us so much for defeating them that, you know, that was it. But, you know, Philippine Sea kind of fit into their overall strategy that they had planned from the 1920s when they when they were faced with the prospect of a battle with the United States, but we had whittled them down so much it had not panned out the way they planned. I'll put it that way. They had wanted to meet us in the Central Pacific.
And we did meet them, and much to their chagrin. David,
right.
Thank you so much for being with us. Is your book, The Battle of the Philippine Sea, available? I mean, you mentioned it was published in 75, but people are still talking about it.
It's out of print. Yeah.
Are you going to do anything to make it available as an e-book?
I had not thought of that. I guess I could. I could talk to someone and see if that could be done.
Yeah. Okay.
As a matter of fact, David, get in touch with me afterwards. I'll put you in touch with my e-book publisher. He'd be happy to talk to you.
Who is this?
Eric Hamill.
That's Tom. Okay. That's Tom Cleaver, David.
Yeah. All right.
Eric Hamill is my publisher, and he's very good about e-books.
Yeah, I'll look into it. Appreciate it.
All right, David, thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for joining us, sir. Have a great night.
Certainly.
All right,
bye-bye.
Thank you. All right, Tom and Ken Glass, we are so very honored to have you here.
Well, thank you. The folks of
the Greatest Generation who actually did the fighting in World War II, obviously reality and human beings being what they are, we don't have as many of you guys left as I would like to, but tell us a little bit about your service as a United States Naval Combat Aviator in World War II on the Hornet and what else you've done. I want to hear all about it.
Okay, well, I want to talk a little bit about what you both have been talking about. And bring a little different angle to it. If I remember correctly, there were probably 12 carriers. We had 12 carriers in four different divisions. I was in part of 58.1, and that particular group was under the charge of Admiral Jocko Clark. I'm sure many of you have heard of Jocko. And just at the a few days before the turkey shoot, we were dispatched north up to the Bonin Islands, Chichi and Iwo Jima, with the hope that our fighter pilots could destroy a lot of Japanese airplanes up there. And as it turned out, that's exactly what they did. And I believe the other carrier, there was one other carrier that accompanied us north, and I think it was under Admiral Reeves, but I'm not absolutely certain about that. Well, on the...
Essex was up there, too.
Who was?
The Essex was up there at the same time you guys were, Ken. That was under Admiral Harrell. Now 58.3.
Are we talking about the same period of time now? This was just I always understood there were only two of us up there, Tom. Two carriers.
The Essex, the Princeton, and the San Jacinto went up, and they got in there about a day after you guys did, and then on the 17th, you guys all got they got definite word that the Japanese were coming, and you guys all made a high speed run back down to the Marianas and got there on the 18th in time to go out looking.
Now here's where I want to pick up my story, because on the way back they received word, Admiral Clark received word that about these Japanese carriers, and he requested permission for the Hornet and one other carrier to circle around behind and cut them off. And the other carrier that was with the Hornet at that time, and I think it was Reeves, he refused to go. And, of course, Clark was very, very upset by this. And it was his intent that we could circle around behind and cut those carriers off And that would have been just before the 19th, of course, when they sent all their Japanese planes over. That's a story I don't think anybody really ever heard too much about.
No, that's not, but it's certainly in character
right
with Jocko Clark. Jocko Clark was the most aggressive commander under Spruance.
Yes, he was. He was another Bull Halsey, wasn't he?
I think
he
actually
was.
He was Bull Halsey with a little bit more likelihood. I don't think Clark would have made the run. Would have made the run north at Leyte Gulf without leaving battleships behind.
That's probably true. Yes, I'm sure that's probably true. Well, anyway, we got the other carrier wouldn't go, and so we were ordered back, and we were back in the area then on the 19th when the Turkish shoot took place, and as Tom so adequately described the night flight and all that, I didn't happen to be on that night flight. When the squadron first formed up, I was the wingman for the skipper of the squadron, Jack Arnold. And the first couple months we were out there, he remained as the skipper, and of course we would have always been on the first flight of every combat mission. Well, about that time he was promoted to air group commander, and that left me joined up with another group of planes that I normally wouldn't be flying with. And so on the very night of this extended trip over the water at night, I was not assigned to that flight. Maybe luckily so. So I missed that. I was standing by in the ready room as part of a volunteer group to go on a second flight, which never developed. So that part of it. Now, I don't know. I can tell you a little bit about my experience out there. We got out in the Pacific in March, middle of March, and our first combat flights were over the Palau Islands. We were sent there to mine the harbor because they wanted to bottle up the Japanese ships that were in the harbor. And I've been told and read somewhere that this is the only time in World War II that aerial mines were ever dropped. And that was our mission, to go into the harbor there and drop these mines. And on the very first combat hop off the carrier, we have those infamous join-ups at night we're usually under a cloud and raining and low ceilings, and you're up there in that blackness plane. You run into slipstreams. You think you're certainly going to run into a plane at any time. Very scary situation, almost worse than being in the combat flight itself. But finally we got joined up on this first mission, and by the time we got, the idea, of course, was to be over the target at first light. We got there actually a little bit after daylight, and we made our approach down between these two, on the islands there, these two big hills. And, of course, they were shooting anti-aircraft fire at us from both sides. And we went on into the harbor and were able to drop our mines. And successfully so. And I don't want to carry this on too far, but then just bring a summary to the whole thing there. It was a very successful mission. And we did mine the harbors. In our torpedo squadron, two of our pilots were shot down and picked up by submarines. We lost two more planes on the carrier in the darkness. One hit an island, spun off. The pilot and the crew were killed. We had another plane go off the front without enough speed of the airplane. They got out okay. And then on the second mission, our captain, Brownell, he was famous for not giving us enough deck, and there was plenty of deck that he could have done that. So we lost a lot of planes on these takeoffs. And on the second flight,
Browning
that
is
I
a
had,
legend. We could devote an hour to talking about the infamous Miles Browning.
Yeah, I know. But anyway, on the second flight, my engine coughed, and I was able to keep the plane in the air for about 2 or 3 miles, and I finally had to settle into the water. And we were picked up by the destroyer Monahan, which incidentally later in the war was sunk in a typhoon. And I'd be back aboard the carrier almost immediately, but the weather turned bad, and I had to spend 2 weeks on the destroyer before I finally got back aboard. But all in all, in spite of the fact that we lost a couple pilots, picked up by a sub, lost a couple other pilots, and all in all, it turned out to be a good mission, I would guess, because we did successfully mine the harbor. From there, we went down to New Guinea for a few days.
Right, Hollandia, early May.
Yeah, early May. And then we hit truck, and then after that is when the Marianas campaign started. And the fighter pilots, you know, they're the ones that are well remembered, of course. But we were in the torpedo bomber pilots, which I was a part of. We were in the air, and I had to do a photo run, I remember, over one of the islands. And then I had a couple bombing flights. So we were up in the air doing our part at the same time this was all going on. We were general quarters the whole time we were during that whole day. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, I was going to say, you just brought up an important point, that the American fleet, air fleet, was big enough that while the fighters were flying air defense, that the dive bombers and torpedo bombers were flying strike missions all up and down to Guam, Saipan, to Tinian the whole time.
Yes.
Getting on to Miles Browning, for a lot of people who don't know, at one point the Hornet was known as the Hornet's Nest with him as the captain. Air Group 15 that preceded you guys was actually kicked off the carrier when they got into Hawaii, and I remember when I was
luckily for us.
I remember talking to you about when I was doing the book on VF2, and you commented that those guys from Air Group 15 had seemed awfully happy to be under a cloud leaving the ship. But you didn't.
I can believe it. Are you familiar with Hal Buell at all?
Yes.
Anybody?
Yes.
He was one
of the dive bomber leaders. Wrote an excellent book on the Hornet dive bomber.
And,
Browning.
He was probably the most decorated pilot in the whole air group. He was just an outstanding dive bomber pilot. I was in a flight one time when he dropped a bomb on a Jap destroyer and it went down in 19 seconds. I think he put the bomb right down the stack.
Gents, can I ask you to stand by for a minute or two? We've got to take a quick break here. Can you both stand by?
Sure.
Sure.
Just going to take a real quick station break. Okay, thank you, Ken, and thank you, Tom. All righty, we are going to take just a real quick break here, and more on the Battle of the Philippine Sea, the Great Marianas Turkey Shoot, and all things World War II with Ken Glass, actual veteran of those battles, and Tom Cleaver, U.S. Navy veteran from Vietnam and author of the book Fabled 15, coming up right after this, so don't go away.
Peek-a-boo. Peek-a-boo, smile.
Smile, buddy.
Come on, smile. Oh, honey, he's still not smiling.
Maybe he's not a smiler.
Yeah, maybe he's just not a happy baby.
Maybe he's just being a boy. You know how boys are.
Or maybe he's teething. Oh, poor baby, I think his gums hurt.
Maybe he's just tired.
Or maybe his tummy hurts. He didn't eat that much.
Maybe he's not ticklish.
You think maybe he's scared of a dog?
Maybe he'll outgrow it. Maybe it's a phase.
Maybe he just doesn't like smiling.
Maybe he has autism, and we can definitely do something to help.
Maybe is all you need to find out more about autism. No big, joyful smiles by 6 months is one early sign. Learn the others at autismspeaks.org/signs or see a doctor today for an autism screening. The sooner it's diagnosed, the better. And it can make a lifetime of difference. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
In the wake of a disaster, what one thing can you send that will help people the most? A blanket, a tent, a sandbag, a doctor. Actually, if you send a monetary donation, you send all these things. Even a small donation can make a big impact and can quickly become exactly what people affected by disaster need most.
Want to help those affected by Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines? To donate, visit philippinesrelief.adcouncil.org. That's philippinesrelief.adcouncil.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
In 50 feet, turn left. Why are you driving so slowly?
After a few drinks, I'm taking it slow.
Well, you're not fooling the cop behind you.
What?
Get ready to pay in 0.1 miles.
Getting pulled over for buzz driving could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. Nothing kills a buzz like getting pulled over for buzz driving, because buzz driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
You're listening to Duke Brooks on ConservativeNationRadio.org.
Talking to myself and feeling old.
All righty, welcome back to the Wednesday, June 18th edition of Radio Free America on ConservativeNationMedia.com. Duke Brooks here, and I am joined by author Tom Cleaver, U.S. Navy veteran and war hero from the actual battles of the Philippine Sea. Mr. Ken Glass from Ohio. Ken, you were flying the TBF Avenger. You were on the Hornet, not the San Jacinto, but President George H.W. Bush was on the San Jack, and he went in to bomb Chichijima. He got shot down. Did you ever come across, did you ever meet him?
No, I did not, but I of course, knew after the war was over that he'd been out there at the same time. And I don't think we ever operated with the San Jacinto.
No, San Jacinto was in the Essex task group.
Yeah, yeah. I think we had the Bella Wood. I want to come
Go ahead, Ken.
I'd like to come back. I'd like to come back to that night flight just for a moment. Is that all right?
Sure.
Sure.
Yes, it is.
Because Tom, you know, did a great job talking about that night flight, but what he didn't mention was how Admiral Mitchell ordered the lights all turned on, which was a part of that situation that night, so that the pilots would have some way to steer by to get back. And, of course, the planes were all low on fuel. Some were dropping in the ocean. Everybody was trying to find a carrier to get aboard. Some of the pilots managed to get back to their own carriers, and others did not. Jack Arnold, the air group commander who I'd flown wing on as a skipper for the squadron, he landed, bounced over the cable into some planes up ahead, if I remember correctly, he actually killed somebody.
He came close.
Al Buell, pardon me?
He came close. I can't remember who was it. It was. I should pull it up out of my manuscript. He was just getting the Essex Zeppelin was just getting out of his airplane, and he saw the CAG's Hellcat come over the barrier, and he just froze on the wing, and the CAG's bird took his tail off and came to rest 6 feet from his wing. Had he gotten off the airplane, he would have been killed.
Would have been killed, you know. And Hal Buell, I don't know, you know, Hal and I wrote a book together called The Hornets, the what I can't even think of the name of the book now.
The Hornets Men.
And the Heroic Men. The Hornets and the Heroic Men.
Right.
So, and incidentally, both of us were from Iowa originally when the war started. But Hal Buell, he landed on another carrier, and they gave him a wave off. Tom, maybe you've heard this. He didn't take it. He landed.
Right.
And they did threaten him with a court-martial, but they dropped that in a hurry. So, you know, there were so many things happened that night. Planes dropping in alongside the
carriers
and being picked up. And
It was your Admiral Clark that really got the whole thing about turning the lights. They were Spruance's staff was discussing the possibility of doing it, and Clark just turned on his lights, and you know, I'm bringing my boys home. At which point Spruance said, "Well, as long as he's done that, we'll go ahead and do it." That was Clark that took the risk. Period. He wasn't going to let his guys go in the water without taking the maximum opportunity to help them.
Okay, thanks for that, Dom.
It's another point in favor of your admiral.
And you've heard of the Jocko Jima development up on in the, you know, our carrier went up to the Bonin Islands four times while I was out there. And the weather was always rough, very rough. Sometimes we'd have as much as 30 feet roll on the flight deck. If you came in a little high and took a cut, you took a hard bounce. And if the deck was coming up to meet you, you took another hard bounce.
Well, it was lucky you were in an Avenger that could take that.
I guess.
So that was one
of our favorite hunting grounds.
Yeah, you sank a destroyer up there.
I almost. I brought it dead in the water, and you know, I dropped my 2,000-pound bombs. One hit on one side, one on the other, but it was enough to bring the destroyer to a halt in water. And then I went after it with rockets and machine gun fire, and one of our destroyers a few hours later came up and sank it. But, I was close, Tom.
That was good. Yeah, that was.
Incidentally, on my very last combat flight over to Manila, we spent 6 days up. That was our last combat flights in the Philippines. And on my very last flight, I was leading a flight of 9 torpedo bombers. And when we got near the city, any aircraft fire was heavier than I've ever seen it anywhere, except maybe truck. That was bad, too. But this was really something. We were flying through the stuff, and it was bursting all around. And just as I was getting ready to put our planes in a dive, they picked my wingman off. The plane exploded, and I immediately went in my dive, and as I was going down, my turret gunner said he could see two parachutes open. The third guy obviously went in with the plane. And, of course, nobody ever heard what happened to him afterwards. But as both of you well know, in those days it wasn't unusual for the Japanese to shoot people in parachutes or when they picked them up, behead them on the spot. Pilots were considered war criminals, as you know. So that was a close call from my last. I was lucky to get home. So.
Now you guys went left just at the end of September, and just missed
and just missed
the Philippines, Philippines invasion.
Lady Gulf, yeah. Yeah, we sure did.
But the whole thing that was going on and with Iwo Jima, which is why they were up there, was the Japanese could fly planes directly from Japan to Iwo Jima, and then from Iwo Jima to Guam, and the whole thing was to prevent any aerial reinforcements of the Philippines. Actually, there was one famous pilot on the other side when you guys went up there the second time. The fighters from the task force ran across a whole bunch of Japanese Zeros and shot most of them down. And one guy managed to outfly all of them and get away, and that was Saburo Sakai.
Mm.
He was there. He was there actually to train the pilots. He wrote in his book how ill-trained they were, but he only had one eye at that point. He'd lost his other eye over on when he was shot up over Guadalcanal in 1942. But
really?
The Hellcats got in each other's way. There was 20 of them chasing him, and he was just constantly going for 20 minutes. And he said he probably lost 10 pounds, sweating. But he managed to outfly them. And finally, dove into a cloud and got away. But there was a lot of work done up there and interestingly enough. There's a lot of people say that had they invaded Iwo Jima in the summer in July of 44, it would have been a whole lot easier than it was in February of 45.
Because they hadn't reinforced it, or what?
Right, they hadn't reinforced it yet. It was the strikes in July that made them reinforce and bring in troops. Sakai said that the place could have been taken in 48 hours.
Well, that's the same flight that where I attacked the Japanese destroyer. My roommate, I got a little separated on that flight, and I still don't. As I try to think about it, I don't know why, but I was by myself when I saw this destroyer. Well, the rest of the group attacked a convoy of ships that included some destroyers, and my roommate attacked one with a torpedo. And he got shot down, was killed. I was the second roommate that I lost in the war. So it was kind of a...
That's a
and the weather
serious
was so bad.
What was that?
Ken, let me ask...
Huh?
Oh, go ahead, Tom.
What was your question?
I was going to ask Ken, besides the TBF, what other airplanes did he fly during the war?
The TBF was the only warplane that I flew during the war, but later on I stayed in the reserves for 30 years, and I flew, my most favorite plane, I guess, was the AD Sky Raider, but I had a lot of time in the Corsair, Hellcat. Wow. Every prop plane that was still around I flew, but I got all checked out through ground school to fly jets, and then they decided the runways at Gros Eagle, Michigan, where I was flying out of, was too short, so I missed my opportunity to fly jets.
Did you ever fly the SB-2C Hell Diver?
I when I was the executive officer of the carrier replacement squadron at Barbers Point in the year before the war ended, I tried to fly every plane that you know had been on our carrier, which included the SB-2C, and that's where I first checked out in the Corsairs and the Hellcat. And yes, I did fly the SB-2C.
What did you think of that airplane?
Not off the carrier.
Right. But what did you think of the SB-2C, which was referred to as either the beast. Or the son of a bitch second class? Some people called it the son of a bitch second class. Apparently, the airplane had some issues.
Well, I think in the beginning, most dive bomber pilots had no love for it. They liked the old SBD. But I think as the war went along and they got used to it, it was a pretty good airplane.
Well, the big thing was that in August of 44, they brought out the SB-2C-3. The SB-2C-1C that you guys went out to the Pacific with only had 1600 horsepower, only had 1700 horsepower, and. And so it was actually underpowered, which is why they had all those adventurous takeoffs. And then the second one came. It had 1,900 horsepower, and as John Bridgers from Bombing 15 said, those 200 horses made a lot of difference.
Yeah.
And he was at when they first equipped with the Helldiver in 43, when they were getting ready to deploy, he was the engineering officer. They had to make certain that 800 different modifications had been made to the airplane to make it operational. That was,
wow.
And he wrote in his memoir that working on that airplane, he was reminded of the statement that it had three fewer engines and five more hydraulic positions than a B-17. But when they were on the Hornet, with Browning was saying, you know, that whole thing about you could only have a certain amount of deck. He was telling them that they could only have 400 feet of deck space to get the Helldivers off, and that's when they ended up when they came out to Pearl Harbor, they lost eight Helldivers in training missions just flying up because of Browning's decision that they couldn't have extra space to take off with, and that was the one airplane that they lost any of on their trip out to Pearl Harbor, and so I think that somebody finally convinced Browning to give them 500 feet. But,
I remember you telling or saying that, Tom, about their losses on the way out. And I guess a captain has that kind of control, doesn't he? Be able to say, I don't want you, you're off.
Browning, the funny thing about Browning is this is a guy who was one of the original aviators on the USS Langley. And during the 1930s, he was one of the 10 guys in naval aviation who created the strategy and the tactics that would be used to win the war in World War II. But he also, while he was this brilliant guy with tactics and strategy, he also had this ability, this remarkable ability, to turn everybody he ever met into an enemy. Except for Halsey. Halsey liked him, and when Halsey didn't go out to Midway, because he was sick, Browning was the guy who advised. He was Halsey's chief of staff. He was the one that advised Spruance on the battle, and basically is the guy whose tactics won the Battle of Midway.
And then his final, he
managed when he was with Halsey in Nemea, he managed to make an enemy of Frank Knox, the Secretary of the Navy, who was a man with a long reputation of not taking that. And he also got Ernest J. King, who was a man who had an anger problem himself, mad at him. And that's how he ended up. They gave him the Hornet to get him away from Halsey. And then there was that famous event in Annie We Talked there in May, where they were having the movie on the hangar deck.
I was sitting there.
Yeah, and somebody smelled gas and yelled fire and he got up and started berating people and everybody got scared and they pushed two guys overboard.
What really happened, there were a couple of containers of some kind on the back bulkhead. And during the movie, they dropped off and made a hell of a noise. And nobody knew what was going on, and everybody started pushing forward towards the front of where the movie screen was. And you're right, a couple guys bailed over the side, and he
wouldn't put a boat over to get them, and they drowned. And that's what finally was too much for him. That's what finally got rid of him. He ended up at the National War College for the rest of the war.
It's pretty unbelievable. I mean, I guess I've never been in the service myself. Both you folks, as you're aware, but I've always wondered, how somebody could have judgment of that nature and still be, remain in command and still be commissioned and still have,
Well, he had this great reputation as a tactician. He had this great reputation as a tactician, but the whole thing is, as Ken was saying, the captain sets the tone for everything. When I was in the Navy, our first captain, Damon Cooper, who later, he was considered, He was considered. I have studied him over the years. He was considered by people who knew him. I talked to three different admirals who served under him at various times in their career. Each one of them said that what they learned serving under him was what helped them become an admiral. And he eventually became an admiral. He was in command of Task Force 77 at Operation Linebacker in 1972. But he had a strategy that every man on the ship thought that he knew them personally. He had a good memory for faces, and he memorized names. And when he saw you as he was walking around the ship every day, he would recognize. He'd say hello and to your name and use your name. And at that time, our ship had every award that a ship could get for the various divisions in it and departments in it, and they were all with hash marks. They'd gotten them multiple years. And he left in 1964. He took command of the Ticonderoga, and he was running Ticonderoga during the Tonkin Gulf strikes. But he left and was replaced. He was a guy who believed in following the spirit of the law, the way he ran things. And he was replaced by a guy who ran it by the book. And within a year, with less than a 5% turnover in the crew, the ship lost every one of the awards that it had under him. Command starts at the top, everybody had the feeling that Captain Cooper would not ask them to do something he wouldn't do himself. And that attitude is contagious. And the other attitude is also contagious. You want us to do it just by the book and not put out the little extra effort? Fine, we'll do that. But
Incidentally, I worked under a couple of real good men. My original skipper, Jack Arnold, went on to become a four-star admiral. I think at one time he was head of all the naval purchasing and so forth in Washington at the Pentagon. And Roy Johnson became the air group commander, became a four-star admiral. And he was the admiral in charge at the time of the Gulf of Tonkin incident.
Uh-huh.
And he was out of there, not because of that, but he was nearing retirement by that time.
He was in charge of Task Force 77, right.
Right.
Yeah. The admiral I was working for at that time, I didn't know it at the time.
Well, you were there at that time, weren't you?
I was. The admiral we had was not as inspirational an officer. He had won the Navy Cross at the Battle of Leyte Gulf when he led his air group off of an escort carrier to attack the Japanese fleet. But by the time I knew him, you usually had to swing him aboard about 10 o'clock at night. He was done for the night.
Oh,
he was one of those guys. I found out later he had a son in Los Angeles who was trying to become a musician, and the son's name was Jim Morrison.
Wow.
From the Doors. When all of the Tonkin Gulf stuff happened, the decision. Our group, our admiral was in charge of the destroyers that were down in there, and all of the decisions were really being made by the chief of staff. The admiral was not in a condition to give orders that night.
Gents, we have about 30 seconds left, and Tom and Ken, let me thank both of you not only for serving our country in the U.S. Navy, although you both did it at different times, but thank you for being a part of the show tonight, and I hope to be speaking with both of you again very soon.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Well, I enjoyed it, and I appreciate Tom and you, Duke, for inviting me to participate.
Thank you.
It was a lot of fun.
Thank you so much. Okay, I'll be speaking with both of you gents again very soon. Thanks so much.
Okay.
Have a wonderful night. All righty. Well, that will do it for this episode of Radio Free America on conservativenationmedia.com. Always a pleasure and, of course, an honor to speak with someone who actually fought for America during World War II. Next Wednesday, well, who knows what's going to be coming out of Washington between now and then. and have a wonderful weekend and a great week, and I'll talk to you then.